Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. We're in session 9, dealing with the rise of Zionism. So let's review where we were in our previous sessions. We began that last session in 1914 with World War I. The Jewish National Fund was instituted in that year. In 1915, refugees from Israel formed the Zion Mule Corps, that performed very credibly during World War I. 1916, we come to the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The background of the Sykes-Picot Agreement concerns Colonel T.E. Lawrence, the very famous Lawrence of Arabia. He was one of a number of British officers who supported the Arab uprising against the Ottoman Turks. That Arab uprising was led by Emir Faisal. Now, with that as a background, Sir Mark Sykes from Britain and Charles Francois Georges Picot met together and decided on spheres of influence, negotiated spheres of influence for the various countries once World War I was over. And so they put together these spheres of influence, and this is a focusing in on the international zone of those spheres of influence. The red area is British control. The blue area is French control, and then there was an international zone controlled by Britain, France, and Russia, administered by Britain, France, and Russia. Now, the question I ask, do you see a state of Palestine there? No, the map, of course, is the modern map of the Middle East, but there is no state of Palestine there. There never has been a state of Palestine in that area. 1917, the Balfour Declaration was issued at the encouragement of Arthur Balfour. The declaration read, His Majesty's government is in favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The British then captured Jerusalem, led by Field Marshal Edmund Allenby, and here's a photograph of Allenby entering the holy city on foot out of respect for its holy status. Then in 1918, World War I finally came to a close. Now, what is the biblical importance of World War I? This was an important sidelight that I took us on, and it's very important to review it. We learn that importance in Matthew 24, verse 3, and in verses 7 and 8. In verse 3, Jesus is asked a very important question. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" The key is they want to know the sign of the end of the age. In verse 7 and 8, Jesus answers that question. He says, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginnings of the birth pangs." So nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom are Jewish figures of speech during the first century for a world war. And the term birth pang is a biblical figure of speech for the end days. So the answer to the question, what is the sign of the end of the age? When you see a world war, that is the sign of the end of the age. So World War I marked the beginning of the birth pangs, the beginning of the end of the age. We have been in the last days since 1914. The birth pangs have begun. A Zionist commission was appointed to oversee the Jewish territories in the Jewish community in the mandated area. Chaim Weizmann and Emir Faisal met on a very positive basis, each one stating that they would support the other one's goals and objectives. Weizmann, "I will support Arab goals and objectives." Faisal, "I will support Jewish goals and objectives." Goals and objectives centering around nationalism, Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism, forming their own countries. They even signed the Faisal-Weizmann agreement. However, Faisal soon backed out of the agreement because he was unhappy with the fact that the Zionists had to coordinate with the British, and Faisal was not pleased with that. He pulled out of the agreement. The agreement was never published. It was kept confidential at Faisal's request, by the Zionists for many years. There were pogroms in the Ukraine and Poland and in Russia, and this precipitated the 1919 Third Aliyah. Third Aliyah began in 1919. The Hechelutz, the pioneer organization, also got going under the guidance of Joseph Trumpeldor. In 1920, the British were granted the formal mandate over Israel. And this is the area allocated for a Jewish national home at the San Remo Conference of 1920. Now, the Zionists did geographical and geological studies, and they made a request for Israel's historical borders. They said, we really don't need all that territory. Just give us this territory. Give us our historical borders. Well, the French weren't too interested in that, and so negotiations continued. And finally, Great Britain divided the mandated area in 1921 to 1923. Palestine now became the area to the west of the Jordan River, and the area to the east of the Jordan River all became Transjordan, or fell under the Arab influence, while Palestine would fall under the Jewish sphere of influence. Tel Chai was formed and operating. Sir Herbert Samuel became High Commissioner, and here's Sir Herbert Samuel. Weizmann was elected president of the Zionist organization. Karen Hayesud was the Jewish the United Jewish Appeal, United Israel Appeal, Karen Hayesud was formed, and Histadrut was founded. That brings us to the new material now with the founding of the Haganah. As we come to our next subject, we come to the growth of Jewish self-defense. An important consequence of the Arab uprising in 1920 was its effect on Jewish military activity. The tradition of self-defense went as far back as HaShomer. Remember HaShomer? That was the Jewish Watchman's Guild in the early 1900s. After the war, however, those members of the guild that had survived Turkish mistreatment were prevented by the British from bearing arms. An abortive self-defense effort was initiated by Jabotinsky during the 1920 riots, but that was once more suppressed by the mandatory authorities. Yet shortly afterward, the Achdut HaAvudah, the Union of Labor Party, appointed a special committee to establish a more widely based and clandestine secret self-defense organization simply called Haganah, defense, the defense. It was understood that the organization would be broadly based. Henceforth, defense clearly required more than the protection of an outpost or an isolated settlement. The entire Yishuv, the entire nation of Israel, would now fall within the circle of Jewish security, the entire Yishuv, the entire settlement. Therefore, as the Histadrut assumed responsibility of the Haganah, officers' training courses were organized, weapons were purchased illegally from Europe and smuggled in, and eventually secret armories were built for the production of light weapons. When we advance to the year 1929, we'll encounter additional Arab riots. Now, the riots of 1929 were a critical juncture in the defense program. It was evident now that training would have to include the most able-bodied Jewish youth in Palestine. And here's a picture of the Haganah mobilizing Jewish youth for military training. And that is even true today. Every high school graduate spends a couple of years in the Israeli Defense Forces. While newer and more modern weapons would have to be secured, and so from the outset, the Haganah functioned under the supervision of the Histadrut. Most of its members were Histadrut officials, and its membership was recruited almost exclusively from laboring ranks. It operated out of a single room in Histadrut House in Tel Aviv, and this was Haganah's headquarters, and that would become the embryonic Ministry of Defense. By 1936, the Haganah was receiving larger quantities of Jewish agency funds, accumulating a number of illegal weapons, and enlarging its program of military training. When renewed Arab violence broke out in that year, 1936, the Jewish military leadership decided first on a policy of restraint. In practice, this meant simply that Jewish communities would be defended vigorously without resort to acts of retaliation against Arab villages nearby. And here's a picture of Haganah fighters guarding the village of Migdal Tzedek in 1936. However, Yitzhak Sadeh, the Haganah field commander, placed his own interpretation on the concept of restraint. He included in his philosophy preemptive strikes. His young officers included such teenagers as the Yigdal Alon and Moshe Dayan. It was Sadeh who taught his youthful commanders to plan ambushes, to organize mobile patrols, to anticipate Arab marauders by striking first. The shift from purely defensive to preemptive tactics was made feasible by an agreement newly reached with the mandatory government. Even before the worst of the Arab attacks, the British had raised no objection when the Jews accumulated a certain quantity of their own weapons for the protection of outlying farm settlements. As fighting gained intensity throughout 1936, the Jewish agency demanded additional free legal equipment to protect its isolated farms, and they demanded recognized status for their own guards. Well, Britain was hard-pressed for military manpower, and so the administration granted these wishes, these requests. So light weapons were distributed to some 3,000 authorized gafirs. These were uniformed Jewish auxiliary guards who had parallel membership in the Haganah, and the British accepted this situation. Even more significantly, the man appointed by the British as operating commander of the Gafirs, Captain Ord Wingate, vigorously and imaginatively enlarged Sade's concept of an active defense. So we'll pick up Ord Wingate and his contribution to the Haganah when we get to 1938. So for right now, let's return back to 1920. So we're back in 1920, and the National Assembly is elected. This is another important event in the year, the election of the National Assembly. This took place in April of 1920. Some 20,000 persons, more than 70% of all registered Jewish voters, participated in the balloting. So there was a good turnout, to say the least. The newly elected National Assembly formally opened in Jerusalem in October of 1920. Its 314 members belong to 20 different parties. Things haven't changed much, have they? Its first order of business was to elect a Va'ad Le'umi, an executive board of 36 men and women. Sir Herbert Samuel, impressed by this evidence of Zionist communal purpose, offered the National Assembly certain functional latitude over Jewish religious, cultural, and social welfare activities. So we have here the beginnings of self-government. 1921, the 12th Zionist Congress meets in Carlsbad, Czechoslovakia. Also in 1921, the Arabs riot in Jaffa. Now in 1920, there had been a major Arab riot in Jerusalem. During that year, Sir Herbert Samuel took up his position as British High Commissioner in Israel. His obsession with impartiality led to conciliatory gestures being extended to the Arabs, basically appeasement. The action only encouraged Arab nationalism, and Arab restiveness continued to grow. Renewed trouble began in Jaffa on May 1, 1921. A ragtag group of Jewish communists brashly marched through the center of town in the wake of a Zionist labor parade, and the incident served the Arab nationalists as a useful pretext. They rioted, and violence extended immediately to the countryside, and soon Petah Tikva and other Jewish farms were besieged. By the time the British troops finally suppressed the last attack at the end of the week, 47 Jews and 48 Arabs had been killed, several hundred others on both sides wounded. Now, the riots in Jaffa emptied the port city of its Jewish inhabitants. The exodus of Jews from Jaffa tripled the population of that suburb known as Tel Aviv. The population of Tel Aviv jumped from 3,600 to over 10,000 because of the incident. Now, the Balfour Declaration had been incorporated directly into the San Remo Mandatory Award. However, in Britain itself, by late 1921, there was growing reservations being expressed at the government's pro-Zionist policy. The tables were turning against Zionism in spite of the original intent of the Balfour Declaration. And remember, here's David Lloyd George, and here is his description of the intent of the Balfour Declaration. David Lloyd George said, "The notion that Jewish immigration would have to be artificially restricted in order to ensure that the Jews would remain a permanent minority never entered into the heads of anyone engaged in framing the policy." That was the intent of the framers. But the winds are now beginning to shift. The winds are getting to blow against the Zionists. All right, Transjordan was created. In 1921, the British colonial secretary was Winston Churchill. Now, in late March of 1921, he journeyed to the Holy Land. Then and there, to Jew and Arab alike, he firmly repeated his support of a Jewish national home. Yet his tour resulted in the separation of Transjordan from Palestine and a re-clarification of the Balfour Declaration. With the end of the war in 1918, the entire region east, this is what we call Transjordan, the entire region east of the Jordan River was vaguely included within the Arab sphere. Emir Faisal made no attempt to administer the area. By the summer of 1920, Transjordan was reduced to a no man's land. By the time Emir Abdullah, Emir Abdullah appears on the scene. This is Sharif Hussein's oldest son. In March of 1921, T.E. Lawrence and Churchill revived an idea they had discussed earlier. They would ask Abdullah to stay in Transjordan where he could reign, although not rule for Britain. And Churchill immediately cabled London and obtained its permission to make the offer. He and Abdullah met on May 26, 1921. The offer to Abdullah was as follows. He would establish an orderly government in Amman. He would recognize Transjordan as an integral part of Britain's Palestine, and he would administer the territory in the name of the Mandate. Abdullah accepted, thus establishing an Arab government east of the Jordan River. So here we have the area allocated for a Jewish national home at San Remo. And this is Great Britain's division of the mandated area in 1921 to 1923. Approximately 25% of the original area is now designated as Palestine, the national home of the Jewish people, and approximately 75% is designated for the Arab peoples, Transjordan. The establishment of an Arab government east of the river was Britain's first explicit admission that Transjordan was included in the zone of Arab autonomy. In Britain's thinking, restrictions were slowly being placed on a Jewish national home. We now come to the beginning of Jewish industry. The 1920s witnessed the beginning of Jewish industry in Palestine. In 1921, a brick factory was constructed in Tel Aviv. That same year, a Russian Jewish engineer, Pinchas Rutenberg, obtained a concession from the mandatory government to build the first electric power station in Tel Aviv. And from then on, private Jewish capital steadily established industries of every stripe. 1922, we come to the Churchill White Paper. In 1922, still other restrictions were imposed on the Jewish national home. On May 22nd, Herbert Samuel returned to London to impress on the colonial office the need of dispelling Arab fears on the Palestine question once and for all. This could be accomplished only by, quote, a definitive interpretation of the Balfour Declaration. That was his insistence. His recommendation was accepted. A statement of policy was drafted mainly by Samuel himself for issuance over Churchill's signature. Known afterward as the Churchill White Paper, the document restricted the national home to the area west of the Jordan. It avoided the notion of creating a predominantly Jewish state, and it limited Jewish immigration to, quote, the economic capacity of the country. In stating that immigration should not exceed Palestine's absorptive capacity, the mandatory government adopted a system of issuing permits by categories, laborers, farmers, capitalists, etc. the restrictions imposed no severe hardships on Jewish immigration during the early years of the mandate. What was ominous to the Zionists, rather, was the precedent established for conceivably more drastic limitations in the future. The draft was submitted to the Zionist organization in June. Fearful of losing British support altogether, Weizmann and the Zionist executive reluctantly signed it. The Arab delegation, on the other hand, rejected it flatly. And nothing's changed over all these years, has it? The Arabs have consistently, flatly rejected compromise. The mixed reception notwithstanding, the government published the Churchill White Paper July 1st, 1922, as the official interpretation of the British mandate in Palestine. So this is really the official reinterpretation of the Balfour Declaration. This is the White Paper of June 1922, the Churchill Memorandum, and it describes British policy in Palestine. And now, within the document, we come to this paragraph, which I would like to place up on the screen. The tension which has prevailed from time to time in Palestine is mainly due to apprehensions which are entertained by both by sections of the Arab and by sections of the Jewish population. These apprehensions, so far as the Arabs are concerned, are partly based upon exaggerated interpretations of the meaning of the declaration, the Balfour Declaration. Favoring the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine, made on behalf of His Majesty's government on the 2nd November of 1917. Unauthorized statements have been made to the effect that the purpose in view was to create a wholly Jewish Palestine. Phrases have been used such as that Palestine is to become as Jewish as England is English. His Majesty's government regard any such expectation as impractical and have no such aim in view. See, on this basis, the mandate won swift acceptance in the House of Commons 5 days later and by the League of Nations September 29th, 1922. So the Zionists had suffered a reverse of sorts, but it was hardly a fatal one. Why? Because the preamble of the mandatory award by the League of Nations, number one, recited the Balfour Declaration almost verbatim. Two, alluded specifically to the historical connection of the Jewish people with Palestine, that was recognized, alluded to the moral validity of reconstituting their national home in that country. Fourthly, imposed on the British the obligation not simply to permit but to secure the Jewish national home. And fifthly, expected the British to, quote, use their best endeavors to facilitate Jewish immigration and encourage Jewish settlement in the land. So, Britain and the League of Nations are at odds. Now, in addition, Hebrew was recognized as the official language, and that must have made Eliezer Ben Yehuda very, very pleased. A Jewish agency was authorized to cooperate with the mandatory in the development of natural resources and in the operation of public works and utilities. So it was plain that from the beginning to the end, the League Award was framed to protect the Zionist redemptive effort. The British were accordingly invested with full powers, quote, full powers of legislation and administration, in which the obligation was imposed of ensuring self-government for the Jewish people. Self-government was obviously not intended for the Holy Land on the basis of an obvious Arab majority. It was significant, for example, that the word Arab did not once appear in the mandatory award, and that the Arabs and other nations in Palestine were repeatedly described as merely as non-Jews. This was to be a Jewish national home. Nor was there any doubt that the British government intended to stand behind the mandate. The Bonar Law Cabinet, which succeeded Lloyd George Coalition in October of 1922, firmly rejected every Arab effort to alter Britain's support of Zionism and the Jewish national home. Therefore, a law, therefore, upon which the mandatory administration based its functional activities was signed into law by the King in London on August 10th of 1922 and proclaimed by Sir Herbert Samuel in Jerusalem September 1st. It was the Palestine Order in Council. It included the traditional provisions of freedom of worship, liberty of conscience, and Britain's responsibility to foster a Jewish national home. Sir Herbert Samuel did not hesitate to use his powers of legislation extensively. With its 9,000 square miles, Palestine was divided now into three districts, North, South, and Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem functioned both as the headquarters for its own district and the capital of the mandatory government. So Britain, notice, Britain is now schizophrenic, conflicted over the issue of the Jewish national home, obligated to ensure that it is fulfilled, and yet offering restrictions to the Jewish national home. All right, now we come to the operation of the mandate. When Britain assumed responsibility for the Holy Land, it took over an economic cripple. Britain's initial efforts in Palestine during the first 2 years of its occupation were devoted simply to restoring a minimal degree of law and order. Perhaps the mandatory's single most impressive accomplishment was the establishment of honest and efficient judiciary, honest and efficient system of courts. The mandatory administration expended much effort and talent as well on fostering agriculture. This was a sector of the economy the Turks had ruinously neglected. The government's agricultural department established research stations for improving cultivation and livestock. So with this help, the ravages of cattle plague, locusts, and fruit flies were markedly reduced. Wide-ranging improvements in communications were accomplished by enlarging the rail network, building roads and bridges, further modernizing and augmenting postal, telegraph, and telephone services. Air links were established with Europe and the rest of the Middle East. An international airport was constructed at Lydda, at Lod, and this eventually became Ben-Gurion Airport. This is the Lydda Airport, eventually the Ben-Gurion Airport, in 1936. Here it is in 1956. It's growing, isn't it? And here it is in 2012. It's a large, modern airport today. Here's the entrance to Ben-Gurion when you visit Israel. This is the scene you will see, the entrance of Ben-Gurion. Here is the waiting area. If you're waiting for your flight, you can wait here, get some food, relax, etc. And this is the reception hall. When you come to Israel, this is where you'll be met by friends, relatives, and your tour guide. Now, unquestionably, there were shortcomings in the government scheme of administration. The Jews complained that the mandatory had virtually abandoned its legal and moral responsibility to foster the economic growth of the Jewish national home. The Arabs benefited most impressively from the government expenditures. The departments of agriculture, public health, and education all concentrated heavily on the Arabs. These weaknesses and inequities notwithstanding, it was soon evident that the improvements wrought by Samuel's administration were light years beyond anything Palestine had ever known before. The High Commissioner himself completed his term of office in 1925. In that month, the Hebrew University was inaugurated on Mount Scopus in Jerusalem and with the visit of distinguished figures from abroad. Allenby came from Egypt. Balfour came from England. He was moved to tears by the evidence of progress he saw everywhere around him. Now, writing his final summary report for Parliament, Samuel could allude not merely to the organization of a civil police force, the gradual pacification of the country, the excellent legal system and public services. He could refer meaningful as well to the spectacular rise in the Jewish population since 1917, from 55,000 to 103,000 by 1925. Much of this Jewish growth and progress was the result of Zionist enterprise alone. Yet Zionism benefited in measurable degree from a quality of peace, order, justice, and administrative integrity far superior to that provided by any neighboring government. So God used the British skills to create the foundations of the modern state of Israel. And now we come to 1922, the death of Eliezer ben Yehuda. We move on to 1923, and the mandate is confirmed by the League of Nations. This is the front page of the Mandate for Palestine and Transjordan Memorandum. It was presented to the UK Parliament in December of 1922, prior to it coming into force in 1923. 1924, we come to the Fourth Aliyah. In 1924, the population of the land was augmented by an unexpected and sizable influx of Polish Jews. The Polish government had nationalized those branches of industry and commerce in which Jews were most heavily represented and then dismissed the Jewish employers in favor of Poles. As a result, a fully one-third of the nation's Jewish merchants were driven to bankruptcy and immigration soon became their only hope. Poland in 1924... Poland had instituted an economic pogrom. So between 1924 and 1928, 70,000 people made their way to Palestine. The arrival of this fourth Aliyah included 8,000 Jews from the Caucasus and from the Middle East. The fourth Aliyah raised the Jewish population in Palestine from 84,000 in 1922 to 154,000 in 1929. Now, few of the newcomers were animated by labor, Zionist, or even agricultural ideals. Fourth Aliyah immigrants generally gravitated to the cities and towns where they set up duplicates of the enterprises that they had left behind. It was the newcomers of the Fourth Aliyah who laid the basis for the issue's urban economy. Within 5 years, they doubled the Jewish population of Jerusalem and Haifa. And by the same token, their immigration was largely responsible for making a city out of Tel Aviv. It was the influx of Fourth Aliyah that swelled Tel Aviv's population to 16,000 in 1924 and to 46,000 in 1929. From then on, growth produced its own momentum. Tel Aviv boasted 160,000 inhabitants just 10 years later in 1939, all of them Jewish people. All right, Technion now opens in Haifa. Technion is Israel's major engineering university. Construction began in 1912. Here's the beginning of construction. Construction continuing here in 1913. And here is Technion today. Technion. All right, let's move to 1925. Hebrew University in Jerusalem is opened. A Hebrew university had been the dream that began fairly early in the Zionist movement. Weizmann referred to such a dream as early as 1903. This dream came to pass in June of 1925 with the inauguration of the school on Mount Scopus. Judah Magnus, an American-born Reform rabbi, became the chancellor of the school. So here's a photograph of the ceremony of the founding of Hebrew University, 1925. A large crowd met to celebrate that. Here is a couple of pictures of the modern campus, Hebrew University in Jerusalem. 1927, the death of Ahad Ha'am Asher Ginsberg, and here is his grave in Trumpeldor Cemetery, Tel Aviv, Ahad Ha'am. Now let's explore the roots of self-government a little bit more. In July of 1927, the mandatory government issued an ordinance formally recognizing a single Jewish community, the Knesset Yisrael, with its own religious and secular organs. The religious organ was the rabbinical council that had already been functioning for a number of years. In the secular area, the National Assembly, with its Va'ad Le'umi, now also were granted official status. For the yeshuv, these measures represented a limited but potentially important new avenue for self-government. 1929, the Arabs riot in Jerusalem. In 1929, Arab restlessness continued to grow. As it happened, violence was to be ignited in a very unlikely location, the old city of Jerusalem. There, Jews and Arabs had been living in close proximity for several centuries. There, abutting the Haram Es Sharif complex of mosques, was the venerated Jewish Western Wall, a remnant of the ancient temple. The wall belonged to the Muslim community. By tradition, extending back at least to the Middle Ages, the Jews enjoyed an easement to the strip of pavement facing the historic buttress and the right to prayer at the wall itself. So here's a drawing of the Western Wall in the 19th century. You can see the easement and the strip of pavement right up against the wall that the Jewish people were allowed to use for prayer. Now I want to point out a little door in this painting way down there at the far end. You'll see that door in other pictures. It'll help you orient yourself where you are in regard to the Western Wall. Now in 1928, shortly before Yom Kippur, the Jewish sexton at the wall placed a screen on the flagstones to separate men and women, according to Orthodox Jewish practice. The Arabs immediately complained that the status quo had been violated. The British authorities agreed and ordered the screen removed. The Jews complained, but to no avail. Subsequently, the entire yeshuv, religionists and non-observant alike, expressed indignation at the wanton interference with Jewish freedom of worship. The Zionist organization submitted protests to London. The Arabs, meanwhile, appealed to the Muslim world, charging that the Jews intended to seize control of the venerated Al-Aqsa Mosque within the Haram area. And nothing has changed today. The same accusations are still floating around. Here's the Western Wall in 1870, and you can again see the easement and the pavement at the bottom of the wall. There's that little door again, just to help orient you to where the pavement and the easement are. This is prayer at the Western Wall, the Jewish women praying. And this is a look at the Western Wall in 1934, and guess what? We're at that little door this time. So we're at the far northern end of the prayer area in this photograph. And this is the Western Wall today. This is the prayer area today. Here are Jewish men worshiping and praying at the Western Wall today. However, here is a news article that was published in 2014. It came out in Israel National News. It was headlined, "Palestine Religious Leaders, Jews Must Not Pray at the Kotel." That's the Western Wall. The Palestinian Authority claims the Western Wall of the Temple Mount is part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, too, and therefore off-limits for Jews. Now, here's the argument. This is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, located right here. And in this area, we have the Western Wall Prayer Plaza. And the Muslims say that this entire complex, the entire Temple Mount, is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that the Jews are trying to take it over. That's the position of the Muslim authorities. The article continues, "Allah decreed that the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islamic and belongs to Muslims alone. It's part of the religious beliefs of 1.5 billion Muslims, and the Jews have no right to it." And again, here's another view of the Temple Mount from the south looking north. There's the Al-Aqsa Mosque, located at the very, very southern end of the Temple Mount. And to the west is the Western Wall Prayer Plaza, located right here. And again, this entire complex is determined by the Muslims to be the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The whole thing is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, according to their position. And they continue in the article, "No party, no matter how much power and international support it has, can change this established fact by giving the Jews any right to it, or the right to pray in any part of it. The Al-Aqsa Mosque includes all its courtyards," see, all of the Temple Mount, "and specifically its Western Wall." So there's the argument even down to today. Back to 1929. At the initiative of the Mufti's Supreme Muslim Council, Arab workers set about building operations in the neighborhood of the wall to interfere with Jewish worship. An especially noisy Muslim religious ceremony was launched to disrupt Jewish prayers there. Months of protests and counter-protests followed. On June 11, 1929, after prolonged evasiveness by the mandatory government and repeated consultations with the legal offices of the Crown, the High Commissioner notified the Mufti that the Jews were entitled to worship without disturbance. The building operations might continue, provided that no disturbance caused was caused to Jewish worshippers during the customary times of prayer. Neither Jews nor Muslims were satisfied with the decision. On August 16th, a right-wing Jewish youth group sought permission to conduct a peaceful march on the wall. The British Acting High Commissioner, Sir Harry Luke, approved the youth group's request. Immediately, the Muslim leadership organized a turbulent counter-demonstration near to the wall, delivering inflammatory speeches and provoking minor skirmishes. During the subsequent week, Muslim agitators traveled throughout the country, exhorting the peasantry to protect Al-Aqsa against Jewish attacks. Finally, on the night of August 23rd and the next morning, crowds of Arabs armed with weapons poured into Jerusalem. The newcomers gathered near the mosque courtyard to be harangued by the Mufti. Then at noon, an Arab mob attacked the Jewish quarter, and violence spread rapidly to the other areas of Palestine, resulting in massacres in Hebron, Jaffa, and Tel Aviv. In the late afternoon, Arab bands descended on the Orthodox Jewish community in Hebron, murdering 67 and wounding 50 inhabitants. Other assaults were carried out in Haifa and in Jaffa and in Tel Aviv. Numerous Jewish agricultural villages were also attacked. The Royal Air Force contingent in Amman, Jordan, was inadequate to restore order, while the Arab police were sympathetic to the rioters. The acting high commissioner was obligated to telephone Egypt for military assistance, but the main body of troops did not reach Palestine until 3 days afterward. Order was not restored until August 28th, 5 days later. By then, 133 Jewish people had been killed, 399 wounded. The Arabs had suffered 178 casualties, in which 87 had been killed. The High Commissioner rushed back from England and issued a proclamation on September 1st that furiously condemned the Arab atrocities. He then proceeded to levy heavy collective fines on Arab towns and villages. However, the effect of these measures was soon dissipated. No sooner had the Mufti protested the High Commissioner's brutality, so fines and heavy collective fines are brutality, so as soon as the Mufti had protested the High Commissioner's brutality, the High Commissioner issued a second proclamation a few days later, stating that an inquiry into the conduct of both sides would be held as soon as possible. In response, the Jews, appalled by the implication that the murderers and the victims were somehow on a common level, turned to London for redress. And now we come to the Shaw Report of 1930. At this critical moment in the Yeshu's fortunes, the Zionists learned to their dismay that they no longer enjoyed the backing of a sympathetic government in England. Ramsay MacDonald was now the Prime Minister, and the Colonial Secretary was Lord Passfield. Now, MacDonald himself had visited Palestine in 1922 and returned declaring that British promises to Jews and Arabs were contradictory. He saw the schizophrenia of the British government at this time, stating that they would support a Jewish national home, but at the same time placing restrictions on it. Weizmann soon discovered which way the wind was blowing upon reaching London. For the first time in his experience, the Zionist leader encountered a chill atmosphere. He was unable at the outset to secure an interview with Passfield. And when Passfield finally received Weizmann, he bluntly declared himself opposed to mass Jewish immigration into Palestine. Other shocks were in store. The political ramification of the violence would continue for a year and a half and encompass a torrent of controversy that threatened the very future of the Jewish national home. In mid-September, the Colonial Office dispatched a Royal Commission. This is Royal Commission number 2. They dispatched the Royal Commission to Palestine to inquire into the immediate causes which led to the recent outbreak in Palestine and to make recommendations as to the steps necessary to avoid a recurrence. The chairman of this commission was Sir Walter Sidney Shaw. And here is a picture of the Shaw Commission. The commission conducted its hearings over a period of 5 weeks and finally issued its report on March 31, 1930. It found the Arabs responsible for the violence. The commission went on to state that the fundamental cause of the tragedy was, quote, Arab feeling of animosity and hostility toward the Jews, consequent upon the disappointment of their political and national aspirations and fear for their economic future, end quote. So the mandatory administration was urged to, number one, tighten its control of Jewish immigration, two, protect Arab tenants from eviction by Jewish land purchasers, and three, ensure that the Jewish agency understood henceforth that it was in no sense empowered to share in the government of Palestine. So here are the limitations: Jewish immigration, Jewish land purchase, Jewish government. The heart of Zionism is being torn out of it. The report aroused consternation among the Zionists and jubilation among the Arabs. The Arabs had just been rewarded for violence. Now, subsequent government measures intensify these reactions. On May 2nd, the Colonial Office instructed the mandatory to suspend the latest Jewish immigration schedule of 3,300 labor certificates. 2 weeks later, in a statement presented to the League Mandates Commission, the British government declared that it viewed the Shaw recommendations favorably and was considering additional measures for suspending Jewish immigration and for protecting the Arab population. Although the League body rejected, the contention that Arab rights could best be protected by limiting Jewish immigration and land purchases, London, nevertheless, proceeded to explore further the recommendations outlined in the Shaw report. So London is at odds with the League mandate. They're simply defying it here. And this brings us to the Passfield White Paper. In May, London dispatched Sir John Hope Simpson to Palestine. Hope Simpson embarked upon 3 months of travel and investigation and aerial surveys of land holdings. He then issued a massive 185-page report of his own, October 20th, 1930. Here is the John Hope Simpson report. It was Hope Simpson's conclusion that the land available to Arabs was less than previously had been believed. The Arabs, he said, gradually were being driven off the soil by Jewish land purchases and the Jewish National Fund policy of not reselling to Arabs or allowing them employment in Jewish tracts. He felt that this was a distinct breach of the mandate. The report doubted Palestine's capacity to sustain any meaningful industrial growth, which of course is ridiculous, especially from our vantage point of 2019. Further measures should be taken to restrict both Jewish immigration and Jewish land purchase. So again, a knife is being driven into the heart of Zionism. Hope Simpson expressed his personal belief that when all development schemes were in full operation, there would be room in Palestine for 20,000 additional immigrant families, about 100,000 people, and of these, not more than half should be Jews. The Zionists, shocked and angered, were not tardy in rejecting Hope, symptoms, data, and conclusions. They too saw the knife being plunged into the heart of Zionism. The man had grossly underestimated the amount of cultivatable land in Palestine and had overestimated the quantity required either by Arabs or by Jews. His attempt to blame Jewish immigration for Arab village poverty was libelous and inflammatory. In contrast, there had been a dramatic rise in Arab living standards as a consequence of Jewish settlements. The irrefutable evidence was that Arab immigrants, no less than Jews, were flooding into the country as a result of new economic opportunities provided by the Jewish national home. And this is the point of Joan Peters' book From Time Immemorial. Read this book. She documents very clearly that there was a tremendous Arab influx into the land because the Jewish community was providing economic opportunity the Palestinians, the Arabs, were not there from time immemorial. And so she throws the false claim right back in their face, using it as the title for her book. They were not there from time immemorial. That is her contention. They came there because the Zionists, the Jewish people, came and provided economic opportunity. Now, before these arguments could be marshaled against the Hope Simpson report, an official statement was made on the same day, October 20th, that the Hope Simpson report was published. It took the form of a 23-page white paper issued by Lord Passfield, the Passfield White Paper. The document proceeded to skewer virtually every Zionist hope for the future. For example, it stated, "There remains no margin of land available for agricultural settlement by the new immigrants, with the exception of such undeveloped lands as the various Jewish agencies hold in reserve." Now, Hope Simpson could be excused for his error because he didn't count on Jewish ingenuity or on God's blessing. Here's an article by Wikipedia dealing with agriculture in Israel. Agriculture in Israel is a highly developed industry. Israel is the major exporter of fresh produce and a world leader in agricultural technologies, despite the fact that the geography of Israel is not naturally conducive to agriculture. See, he could be excused for a big mistake. He didn't count on Jewish creativity or God's blessing. More than half the land area is desert, and the climate and lack of water resources do not favor farming. Only 20% of the land area is naturally arable. But here's the way Israel looks today. It is a thriving agricultural land today. There's an example. Here's a huge vineyard. Israeli agriculture is thriving today. This is the Jezreel Valley. Notice how it is filled with farms today. Anyway, the land is thriving from Jewish ingenuity and God's blessing. Passfield, this is the Passfield White Paper. Passfield said that Jewish immigration must be suspended as well, as long as extensive unemployment in Palestine continued. The Passfield White Paper appeared to repudiate the very purpose of the Balfour Declaration and the terms of the San Remo Award. It foreshadowed serious immigration restrictions and threatened the Jews with an embargo on additional purchases of land. More significantly, it commented upon the work of the Jews in Palestine in disparaging terms, omitting altogether to credit the Zionists for the benefits they had conferred upon the country and all of its peoples. There was little wonder the Arabs expressed general satisfaction with the document. The Jewish reaction was quite different. Outraged, Weizmann immediately resigned as president of the Jewish agency. Weizmann's was perhaps the most temperate Zionist reaction. The response in the Jewish world, in Palestine, in Britain, in America, was altogether infuriated. Besides letters, petitions, cables of protest, and impassioned newspaper editorials, it took the form of endless individual and collective meetings with British public figures. Now, some of these British public figures hardly needed to be persuaded that the British government had betrayed a solemn trust. Stanley Baldwin and the Conservative Party promptly disassociated themselves from the Passfield White Paper. Leopold Amory and Winston Churchill cursed the document in the House of Commons. In a heated parliamentary debate on November 17th, Lloyd George scored MacDonald for breaking the word of England. Now, MacDonald was shaken by the intensity of the attack upon him and the schisms even among his own Labour Party. The Prime Minister invited Weizmann to lunch on November 6th. Years later, Weizmann's widow published her husband's account of the meeting. The Prime Minister acknowledged errors in his white paper and stated, "The errors have to be put right, the misunderstandings to be cleared up, and any new statement which is to be issued in agreement with you. But we cannot simply withdraw the white paper." So now we come to 1931 and McDonald's letter. The agreed-upon face-saving device for the policy shift took the form of a letter from the Prime Minister to Weizmann on February 13, 1931. McDonald's letter significantly reinterpreted the Passfield White Paper. In effect, the document was a reversal, for it said, "The obligation to facilitate Jewish immigration and make possible dense settlement of Jews on the land is still a positive obligation of the mandate, and it can be fulfilled without jeopardizing the rights and conditions of the other part of the Palestine population." So you see, the letter admitted that the number of Arabs dispossessed was surely less than Hope Simpson had determined and required more extensive investigation. Meanwhile, it gave additional assurance that the prohibition of further land purchase by the Jews was not government policy. The authority of the Jewish agency to employ Jewish labor on purely Jewish ventures was confirmed, as was the right of Jewish workers to secure a fair share of employment in the mandatory government and in public works projects. In McDonald's summary, he stated, "The obligation laid upon the mandatory are solemn international promises, and there is no intention at present, as there was not in the past, of disregarding them." Although the letter did not enjoy the status of a command paper or of a colonial office announcement, McDonald released it to the press. He transmitted it as an official document to the League of Nations, and embodied it in a dispatch as instructions to the Palestine High Commissioner. Weizmann rightly interpreted it as official and hailed it as reestablishing a basis for Zionist cooperation with Britain. It did little, however, to encourage cooperation between Arab and Jew. The Passfield White Paper and the McDonald letter revealed British policy at its worst. Both documents, the Passfield paper and McDonald's letter, convinced first the Arabs and then the Jews that sufficient agitation and pressure could reverse the intentions of the mandatory government. If you're vocal enough or violent enough with Britain, you'll get your way. The Arabs did it violently, the Jews did it vocally. And certainly the Arabs did not regard McDonald's letter as the final word. The president of the Arab executive, Musa Kazim al-Husseini, wrote to the High Commissioner these words, February 19, 1931, "I want to assure Your Excellency that Prime Minister McDonald's letter has ruined hope of a policy cooperation between Arabs and Jews, if there existed such a hope, and has rendered the possibility of understanding between the two parties absolutely impossible." All right, well, then the 17th Zionist Congress met at Basel, Switzerland. All right, well, I see I am down to maybe a minute and a half left, and I think this would be a good place to call it quits in this session. We'll pick it up next session with the split in the Haganah, the Irgun Zvi Le'umi Etzel is founded. So we will pick up our study in Zionism and the history of Israel next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We'll catch you next time. Lehitra'ot.